So can you hear me? Please respond on the chat. I'm impressed by the camera. It's really good.
It's faster than it ever was before. More motion in both.
Yeah, they're good.
You must be getting better bandwidth.
No, we're just naturally brilliant.
It's because it's you.
You wait till it crashes. Fine. 2 minutes into the system. I mean, this system's been up now and running since. He says, I thought it was starting at 5. I got it going around 4:15. So. Okay. So what you're going to learn today is start the basics of parallel computing. We will continue on the foil set that Nancy started. You should all have this program called Web Wisdom running. Should say, what is parallel and distributed computing at the top of the Netscape page. Srinath asked about textbooks. We will only need one textbook on this technology called MPI. We will buy them for you and ship them down to you. We won't get to MPI, which is the sort of key, relatively simple, but base technology until about a week and a half, 2 weeks. It's our gift to you for putting up with our boring lectures. So I will be down to see you September 15th. So I'll be visiting Jackson then. Is everything ready to go?
Not yet. I'm assuming I'm not showing Web Wisdom. showing up in their tangles at all.
Who, give an example of somebody who is not getting web wisdom. But there are not many people who have web wisdom open. They have to do it because it says unable to remote open. Roman, do you know what that means? There's some connectivity problem. Ha ha! Maybe these... Don't all of them have web wisdom? So they've made... So this is the stupidity of these different options. So they need to rejoin, selecting Virtual University. Hi, so do you want to see what... Yes, so that's a screw-up. This is some stupid option that Tango has, which we should abolish. You need to exit from Tango, and when you join it, you have a menu at the top, and you must select Virtual University. Just exit, rejoin immediately, and select Virtual University. All right, Lin Jun, I'm going to open you. And Martin. And... So how is that looking? When you get web wisdom, it will have some wishy-washy words, and then after, in less than 30 seconds, it should give you a page saying parallel and distributed computing. Does everybody have web wisdom? What's wrong with user Jin? So Jin's machine is dead. He needs to which URL do you wish to bookmark? Are we ready to go? Ready for dinner? Whoever is Lem, could they just implement raised hands? All right, I'm going to start. Is there any problem? Will somebody go to the mic and tell me if it's all ready to go? I see Mike checking things out. All right. Okay, so we're just about to start. And we are starting on this file called What are Parallel and Distributed Computing? And remember, this is a class on computational science, which is meant to teach you how to use large-scale computers to do simulations and other large-scale computations. And in order to do that, to get enough performance, we need to use parallel computing in general, and here we just essentially just starting our discussion of general discussion of parallel computing, and we notice that parallelism, as we'll see later on, is sort of trivial. You just take a bunch of computers and get them to work together on the same problem, and the critical feature of them is that all these computers are actually coordinated to solve the same problem. And the essence of parallel computing is studying that coordination. Now, you will also see the term distributed computing, which is more or less the same meaning, except it has operationally a very different implementation, because in parallel computing, you have an extremely tight coordination. These processes are working very closely together, whereas in distributed computing, one implicitly has a very loose constraint between the processes. That translates into actually the software for distributed computing being a lot easier and the hardware having much less constraints. So now we're going to onto the next transparency, and you should now have a transparency that says why parallel computing. So let's hope that's true. So this is actually a slight review of what Nancy said at the end of last time, and the main point of this foil is to notice that not parallel computing actually has several drivers. One is the demand to get actual higher performance. The other is that the poor old computer architect designing machines doesn't understand how to get this performance from a single machine. I noticed that somebody asked what latency is. That's Srinus. So latency is the following. So when I'm communicating with you, I am sending information, and latency is the time it takes to start up the information and from the time it takes from me starting to you receiving it. So latency is the startup time. And if you want very tight coordination, you must have very low latency, because otherwise you'll spend all your time waiting for this thing to start. If you have very loose coordination, it doesn't matter. So a good example in the real world is what we're doing now has relatively low latency. If I phone you, that's a low latency form of communication. If I write a letter, that's a very high latency. It takes 3 to 5 days for a letter to travel across the America, whereas the phone will travel in seconds. So actually in the real world we see different choices for communication which make different trade-offs. Actually, phone versus mail is a good illustration of these differences between distributed and parallel computing. The phone is more analogous to parallel computing, very tight interactive constraints. The mail is like distributed collaboration between people. You do not expect people to immediately respond to mail. So actually, one of the reasons to do parallel computing is actually distributed computing is getting a lot more popular, and the reason it is because of the web. So now we'll go to the next foil. And we'll go through a little later in this foil set, not today, some basic issues in technology, and the essential driving force in technology is that transistors are getting cheaper and smaller. And so if you take a CPU chip, a modern CPU chip might have 10 million transistors in it. Actually, it only takes 500,000 transistors to make a pretty good central processing unit. So what do you do with these 10 million transistors? You put in actually some form of parallelism. So actually a modern CPU has a substantial amount of built-in so-called instruction level parallelism. As they get more and more transistors, a little after the year 2000, they'll have 100 million transistors on the chip. They're going to get more and more parallelism on the chip. And so this is somehow another feature about parallel computing. It's inevitable from the point of view of technology. Okay, so we'll now go on to the next foil. So this, again, I think you might have done last time. It points out some of the types of problems that the technologies we're discussing in this course are aimed at solving. So here we've listed three classes of problems. The first class is large-scale engineering simulations, and so the possibly the best example of that is aircraft simulations. Computational fluid dynamics is used on a straightforward basis in the design of a modern aircraft. It's replacing more and more wind tunnels because you can do a CFD stands for computational fluid dynamics. You can do a simulation a lot faster than you can build a model and stick it in a wind tunnel. There's other types of areas that are mentioned here. Obviously, weather forecasts, environmental studies. There are a lot of applications of large-scale computing, parallel computing in the oil industry. There's another class of applications I mentioned here which come from more academic applications. The top ones are commercial or government applications. So here we're basically talking about fundamental physics, chemistry, and biology. And the final set somewhat different from the first set. They're still real-world applications, but they're not necessarily solving differential equations. And so here we're talking about an increasing use of large-scale computers to so-called do data mining, which is trying to take all these large databases people have and try to extract information of them. And actually, Wall Street makes extensive use of parallel computers in trying to simulate the performance of various financial instruments, such as not only just stocks, but all these complex things that they build. So we will not spend much time on these next two foils because the way they're displayed, they're almost unreadable. The main thing to gain from this foil, which is a performance of essentially the largest computer that exists at any one time, is that if you do a so-called log linear plot, so you plot it linearly against time, but you plot the log of the performance. So a megaflop is a machine that performs a million operations per second. A teraflop is a machine that performs 10 to the 12th operations per second. Then you will see that currently, today, the fastest machines are a little faster than a teraflop. And if you look at the behavior of this fastest machine, it is essentially a logarithmic plot. It's increasing by a fixed factor every year, and that factor is expected to continue for probably another 10 years. So this logarithmic plot should continue for 10 years. And also all the recent machines, which are these yellow blobs are all very large-scale parallel machines. So all the recent performance leadership comes from parallel computers. All right, so I'll skip this foil, which actually replots that same information, and it does it with a smaller number of years, but it tries to write out some applications which get enabled when you reach a certain performance. It turns out a lot of applications become possible when you reach around the teraflop, which is 10 to the 12th operations per second. To get some idea as to where your current PCs are, a single PC is probably running at, it probably runs at 200 megaflops. So that is 1/5,000th of a teraflop. So these high-end machines are something like 10,000 times more powerful than your high-end PC. And when you get to that performance, why it's interesting is it turns out that's a large enough machine to simulate the real world. Now you can do true three-dimensional simulations. Smaller machines can do interesting simulations or illustrative simulations, But in many fields, if you see what it takes to do a three-dimensional simulation with reasonable accuracy, it is a performance of around a teraflop. Now, there are many applications that, because of their complexity, need more than a teraflop, but a teraflop is a useful enabling performance level. All right, so although the most powerful machines are over a teraflop, if you go to your favorite supercomputer center, such as the one at CWES, you will find that their peak performance is now running around a fraction of a teraflop, and the teraflop performance will be coming in the next machines that are being installed. This file here is actually a little old. In the year 2003, the Department of Energy intends to deploy a machine which has a performance of 30 teraflops. And so they have a very aggressive schedule for installing the world's most expensive and fastest machines. So so the next file is just makes a couple of general remarks about the field of parallel computing, which is sometimes called high-performance computing and communication. And it points out it's a field that has actually been studied for quite some years. It's a lot of research has been done, and a lot of agencies have worked in it. And now it's at the stage where, in some sense, it's being deployed. And you're associated with CWES, which is part of the major Department of Defense deployment of computers to enhance the capability of various simulations of importance to national security. But I already mentioned the Department of Energy, which has a big program called ASCII, and NSF, which has another big program. These are all aimed at large-scale simulations. The number of and I would say that in general, we know how to use large-scale computers in the majority of problems. When I started in this field about 15 years ago, it was not known how to do parallel computing in many fields. But nowadays, there's a lot of work to be done in producing refined algorithms and better performance and better software. But we have understood that actually, essentially, every one of the applications of interest can be solved on a parallel machine. All right. So now we'll have a brief overview of what a parallel computer is. We'll come back to this in a little more detail later on, but we just need to know enough about a parallel computer to be able to discuss how to program it, because we want to know how to program it as quickly as possible, because otherwise we won't be able to set you any very hard homeworks. So all parallel computers are very simple, and here we have a picture of what is called a multi-computer, which is a set of replicated nodes with some sort of network joining them together. And each of those nodes consists of a memory and one or more processors. So parallel computing in some level is sort of trivial, because it is just a bunch of computers joining together to solve this problem. And as we point out later in various analogies, what do you do when you want to have people getting together to solve problems? You get them together in a room, and they chat and do other ways of communicating. And that's what computers do. When you want multiple computers together to solve a problem, they each do some computing, and they send messages to each other to tell each other what they're doing, just as humans send messages to each other. So somebody has asked what a teraflop is. So a flop is a floating point operation. Tera means 10 to the 12th, so a machine which has a performance of a teraflop has a performance of 10 to the 12th operations per second, a million million operations per second. So I actually, that's why I said I think 10 to the 12th operations per second rather than the word teraflop. So the abbreviations are megaflop, a million operations per second, gigaflop, a billion, 10 to the 9th operations per second, teraflop, 10 to the 12th operations per second, and what you'd expect to get to around the year 2010 is a petaflop, which is 10 to the 15th operations per second. Actually, the word flop can be replaced by op without a lot of problems, because most of these machines can do essentially an interesting operation, say an integer operation or some basic logical operation. At the same time, they can do a floating point operation. So often people now talk about teraops rather than teraflops. And in fact, when you're talking about information processing, which is analyzing data, the word teraop is more appropriate, because you don't necessarily need to do floating point calculations, scientific calculations, when, say, you're doing image processing, because then you're tending to be doing logical operations on the pixels of an image rather than floating point operations. So, all right, so this is the world's simplest parallel computer, and at some level, every parallel computer looks like this foil saying the multi-computer, an idealized parallel computer. And they differ by the nature of the interconnection network and the nature of the node. So this foil is quite important, because it basically writes down the essential problem in computer architecture. So the central problem in computer architecture is that doing any computing requires taking a processing unit doing integer or floating point operations and joining it to some memory which has data in it, taking the data from the memory, sending it to the floating point unit or the integer point unit, getting some results and sending them back to the memory. And the central difficulty with most computer architectures is that it takes a lot longer to send information back and forth to memory than it does to actually process the information. So the critical difficulty is to try to minimize the time it takes to access memory. So this foil points out that as soon as you get a very large machine with a lot of memory, which will be associated with different nodes of that parallel machine, you're going to find it's going to take a lot less time to access memory near a particular computer than memory that's far away. And now Srinath has asked a good question: what is the maximum number of CPUs that can be interconnected in parallel computing? Well, you can answer that question from two points of view. If you ask the practical answer to that, the practical answer today is around 10,000. You can actually guess that, because the world's largest machines have performances which are around 10,000 times that of a typical high-performance single CPU, which is our typical PC. So the theoretical answer is much larger than that. I used to work with a very brilliant computer scientist called Chuck Seitz, and he always said that computing was like paint. When you needed more paint, you just go and buy another can of paint. And his model for parallel computing was, when you wanted more compute power, you just go and buy another computer, plug it into the network, and you just got more CPU power. And to some extent, that is true. I mentioned that DOE, Department of Energy, is actually producing very powerful machines. Now, one of the ways they're doing that is they're not cleverer than that we are. They're just richer than we are. So they're spending, it used to be true that you only spent $30 million on a so-called supercomputer. So those largest computers all cost $30 million. However, DOE noticed you could spend $90 million on a computer and get one that was three times as powerful. So So it is true that these machines actually, there are many, we'll see this later on, some types of machines you cannot make bigger. They have a fixed upper limit. However, most of the machines that are deployed today, which are very big, they have no limit except the amount of money in your checking account, which you're willing to spend. So these machines, which are 3 teraflop machines, cost $90 million. Those are the DOE has 2 such machines. So actually, here is this latency which I was asked about earlier. If you look at the cost of accessing memory by almost any mechanism whatsoever, there is a fixed initial time called the per message cost or the latency, and then there is the per word cost, which has got a different coefficient. And so if you plot the time it takes to access memory against the number of words accessed, you will tend to get a straight line which does not go through zero for zero size words. And this latency is much higher for information that's stored a long way away in, say, the memories of other processors. Notice this is actually, although we haven't, maybe this isn't the right time to talk about it, this actually points out a central feature of designing parallel machines. So it could be true that on, say, a particular network, that the startup time is actually about equal to the time it takes to transmit 1,000 words, so that in this foil here, which has total time as T sub S at N times T sub W, 1,000 T sub W is equal to T sub S. So that says that the time to transmit 1,000 words is 2 times the time it takes 0 words. So that says if you're going to transmit information when the latency is high, you better transmit a lot of information because it's sort of free after a while. And so actually, one of the hardest issues in parallel computing, sort of technical issues, is to make the number of words transmitted at a time as large as possible, because that's what gets you good performance, but often it's relatively hard to make that work. So these next 2 foils just point out that actually the fundamental problem in parallel computing, which is memory access, is the same problem in sequential computing. If you take I'm sorry, my phone is ringing. So let's ignore my phone. I need to switch it off next time. All right, so it points out here that if you start off with the processor, which is in the top left-hand part of the foil, then we have a succession of memories. There's a cache. Actually, it might have 3 caches. Then you get the main memory, and then you get the disk. So what is a cache? So a cache is just a very, very fast memory, which is not so big. So the central way of designing conventional machines, just the machines that go in your personal computer, one of the key difficulties is designing a good cache system so that most of the information you want is stored near the processor and you do not have to go horrors of horrors to disk, even not quite as bad but still bad main memory. You would like to find it sitting in one of those caches so that you can fetch it quickly. And it's extremely important to try to design algorithms that keep information in cache. And the word that's used to describe this is called data locality. And data locality means that the information is stored near, the information used together is stored near each other so that you can keep the information in cache and do a computation. So this next file here, which is even more complicated, is showing that when you build a parallel machine, which is just three of these sequential processors, it essentially multiplies the problem. It has the same memory hierarchy within a single processor, but then it's even slower when it goes to the memory on a far-out machine. So the issue of parallel computing memory access is just like a complicated version of a sequential computer. And in actually both types of machines, the central issue is data locality. All right. So now we'll describe some of these computer architectures in detail. In olden days, when I gave this course, just leave it. It's fine. So I used to describe so-called SIMD machines and MIMD machines. Actually, today people don't make these so-called SIMD machines, and so we will hardly discuss them at all. And all the machines are the so-called MIMD type. So somebody asked, does speed vary among these three caches? So that's going back to the previous foil, and the answer is yes. Namely, it's rather straightforward that the memory that is the takes the least time to access costs the most per bit, and therefore if you have a fixed budget to build your computer, that memory is smaller. So the idea of these caches is the cache nearest the processor, which is say like registers, which are the fastest, those caches, which the initial one is actually on the chip, those are the fastest, but they're the smallest in size. Then as you go further and further away from the computer, you get memory storage devices which increase in size and decrease in performance. So main memory is reasonably fast, takes maybe 100 clock cycles to access. If you go to disk, disk starts taking, probably disk takes, what would it take? It would take millions of clock cycles to access. And then worse, there will be some tape device which would be even slower, take many seconds to access. And these are machines that are maybe running with clock speeds which are something like 400 megahertz, so doing 400 million operations per second. So the challenge in designing a machine is to take a given dollar budget and divide it appropriately between these various components of varying capability and varying performance. So, okay. So in the so-called MIMD, which it happens to stand for multiple instruction, multiple data, which just means that it's made up of computers, each of which works independently, there are three or four types depending on how you want to divide them, and we will just briefly mention each of those types now. And we will use a color code where red are processors, blue are memory modules, and green are communication networks. Except we don't use it on, but we use a green communication network here. And so the simplest machine is the so-called distributed memory machine. So the distributed memory machine was actually the ones which I originally worked on when we built the first really one that worked very well. So they consist of a bunch of individual processors. Each processor is entirely self-contained, and the only things the processors can do is send messages between them, each other, and those messages have to be decoded by the processor that receives the message. So somebody asked what SIMD was, and somebody else whose name I can't read because it's pink, and pink doesn't show up well on my machine, has pointed out that SIMD stands for single instruction, multiple data. MIMD stands for multiple instruction, multiple data. So in a nutshell, it's a rather peculiar classification. Multiple data means each of these machines have their own memory. Multiple instruction means they each run separate instructions. Single instruction means they each run the same instruction. So the usual analogy is that MIMD machines are like having a bunch of people in a democratic society where everybody's roughly allowed to do their own thing. SIMD machines are like a dictatorship where everybody has to do what the dictator says, so they're like having a single instruction stream which is broadcast to the people. So some of the most important machines, such as the Cray T3E and the IBM SP2, are of this actual simplest MIMD design called essentially pure distributed memory. Most of the more modern machines are trying to elaborate this design and make it a little more complicated. And so here we actually have a color-coded picture. The machine that's shown here is an IBM SP2. Well, you only see the cabinet just full of these processors. Parallel machines aren't actually very interesting to look at because they just consist of a bunch of CPUs and a bunch of memory and some sort of glue logic, which isn't terribly useful to look at. So the big advantage of these machines is they work. The other big advantage of them is relatively straightforward to use them like paint. And you can build essentially arbitrary machines of this, arbitrary size machines of this type, because it is reasonably easy to build interconnection networks that scale reasonably well and can link probably hundreds of thousands of machines of this type. So the main limitation to the size of these machines is not technology, it's money. You cannot afford to build 100,000 of these machines because it would cost the same thing as 100,000 PCs with some additional thing, which will be, I don't know, probably $500 million. So if you have a spare $500 million, you could have 100,000 of these machines, possibly. All right. So these are very workmanlike machines. This technology which we'll learn called MPI will allow us to program these machines. And although they are possibly the hardest to program, they're relatively easy to understand. And so they're probably the best ones to study initially. So I think I'm going to skip the next file, which is a little more detail, which points out that all these machines are essentially the same. And it also has some hints here as to what to do to make them perform well. We'll come back to that later on. All right, so here is a question saying, do distributed memory machines have shared memory? And the answer is, the world is never clean. All machines can have anything. So you can have distributed memory machines that have... So let's actually ask what that means. So when I go, let's go back... here to a picture. So here I have a picture with actually an IBM SP2. I have four processors, four blue memories, and they're joined by the green network. This picture implicitly says that there is one processor at the end of each network connection. Actually, in a modern version of the SP2, you will have multiple processors, because the general strategy in building these machines is to find what is the real world producing in workstations or in PCs. Let us take the most cost-effective machine people are making and join them together. So nowadays, most workstations, at least a lot of workstations, server level at least, have multiple processors, anywhere up to say eight processors. And so machines of this type actually have a shared memory internal to each of these nodes. So now we come to what, actually, for the ever since I've been in this field, which is again some 18 years, there's always been a debate between shared memory and distributed memory. And both types of machines have always been built, and the relative merits of them keeps getting debated. But actually, the trade-off between them has always been roughly the same. So shared memory are very important machines. If you go to a modern business, they will nearly always build their data processing around shared memory machines. And Sun Microsystems essentially only make shared memory machines, and does that extremely successfully. Silicon Graphics was actually very successful with a shared memory machine called the Power Challenge, and the Cray T90, which is the so-called vector supercomputer, that's also a shared memory. And so somebody asks, Srinath asks, so he says, is it half duplex or full duplex? Well, in order to do parallel computing, machine A needs to send information to machine B, and machine B needs to send information to machine A, and so they have to be effectively full duplex. You could implement it as two half duplex channels, but they must be full duplex effectively, because otherwise we can actually do parallel computing properly. So shared memory, you have a set of memories which are accessed directly by all the CPUs. And so actually this picture is shown better on the next foil, which is a picture of the Power Challenge on the right. And so here we have a bus, we have a set of blue processors, a set of red processors, and a set of blue memories, and every processor can access every memory. Actually, if you think back to the previous diagram of the SP2, every processor could access every memory. However, it had, in terms of hardware, it was very different. If it wished to access the memory on its node, it just did a machine instruction which said, go and access this memory, and the value of the memory was returned. If it wished to access a memory on a different node, it had to send a message to the other node saying, dear node, I'd really like to know what's in this particular location. Please send it to me. And so the protocol, which is implied in distributed memory machines, is much more complex for accessing memory which is not on your node than accessing memory which is on your node. That means the latency, which is the overhead of sending these messages and decoding them, is very much higher on distributed memory machines. So shared memory machines are characterized that all processors can access all memories with a single machine instruction of the classic type that's the CPUs use to access memories. And so the huge advantage of shared memory machines is that ordinary computer languages, ordinary binaries run on shared memory machines as well as sequential machines. Whereas in distributed memory, we're going to have to rewrite them. So that's what it says. It's pretty easy to program these machines. However, it's extremely hard to program them optimally because to make them work, one needs to make certain that when, say, two processors access the same memory location, it's logically correct so that they access it in the right order. So that to get good performance and not to get good get bottlenecks is quite hard on shared memory machines. The other critical feature of shared memory machines is they tend to get implemented by some sort of bus, and a bus has limited bandwidth. It is not possible to build a bus that has unlimited bandwidth. You can build a network that has unlimited bandwidth because you can just add more network wires. But a bus is a single integrated entity. It is not possible to make that arbitrarily large. So there's an effective limit to the size of shared memory machines. Today, the largest correctly working shared memory machines come from Cray and Sun. They have 64 processors. The more normal operational systems have 32 or 16 processors. And you cannot build a machine which is larger than that with a shared memory design. All right. So again, we'll skip these detailed notes. So this is a design which is quite popular and is probably pretty important, and it's called distributed shared memory, and it is a hybrid design. And the most famous example of this is the Silicon Graphics Origin 2000 machine. The Hewlett-Packard exemplar is also of this design. So this is a machine that at the hardware level looks like a shared memory machine. So you can access memory locations with machine instructions. However, it's implemented as distributed memory. And it has some very complex, difficult logic to make certain this works. And here is a picture on the next foil of an Origin 2000. So Martin asks a question as to how the allocation and deallocation of memory is controlled. So what architecture are you interested in, Martin? So while Martin makes his question a little more precise, we will continue with this discussion of distributed shared memory. So distributed shared memory, if you look at them physically, they look like distributed memory machines. But rather than having to wrap information up in messages and have them processed by special message processing hardware or special message processing software, there are some special hardware enhancements that allow one to access these remote memory as though it was local memory. So that actually makes it pretty convenient, and it actually does reduce the latency because all this is done with some very very clever hardware. However, it is still true that it takes longer to access memory which is far away than it does nearby. So it does not remove the data locality problem. However, it makes the programming a lot easier because you do not have to send explicit messages. You can just do a memory location access. So Martin says, how is the allocation and deallocation of memory controlled? Well, these are just ordinary Unix or Windows NT computers. You allocate and deallocate memory in precisely the same way as your favorite computer language does it. And if you're running Fortran, it doesn't do it. If you're running C, you use malloc. And if you're running Java, it happens automatically. Remember, for these MIMD machines, each node is a conventional computer. So when I'm thinking about the memory within the node, I just access it and process it in exactly the same way that I would an ordinary sequential machine. When I have a shared memory, every processor can access and can allocate and deallocate memory on any other processor. There will be performance issues, namely if the processor is further away, it will take longer. There will also, more importantly, be control issues. If people start running interference, then it won't work. So there's a very difficult coordination problem. All right. So here is a very important class of problem, computer, called a workstation cluster. So this is, at its simplest, your lab at Jackson State. It's a set of PCs sitting on an Ethernet, possibly connected even to other PCs or workstations, say at CWES, which are sending messages over this network. So this particular architecture is a distributed memory MIMD machine. So the workstation cluster has the identical architecture to the IBM SP2. The difference is that an IBM SP2, although it is essentially a bunch of RS6000 workstations linked together, the network has been customized and optimized to get very high performance. Whereas if you take a set of IBM PCs or SGI workstations or Sun workstations and link them together, your network may not have sufficient performance. However, people have found that you can link together quite a few workstations, many hundreds of workstations or PCs, and get reasonable performance as long as you're careful about your networking. So although we naively said we could start with Ethernet, there are various other networkings. There's certainly ATM, which is not too expensive. There's also custom networking. The most well-known of this in this community is MirrorNet. MirrorNet is built by a company founded by my old colleague Chuck Seitz when we were together at Caltech. I left Caltech, and then he left Caltech about 3 years later to form MirrorNet. And they build a very high-performance network, which is particularly suitable for plugging machines such as PCs and workstations together. So one of the importance of the IBM SP2 architecture is it's a customized high-performance workstation cluster. So that says if you build software that runs for an IBM SP2, there is some chance it will run on a PC cluster. And as you see, whereas probably Jackson State doesn't have a high-end SP2, it has a PC cluster. So you can, in principle, do parallel computing on your cluster at Jackson State. So this brings parallel computing, if you like, to the masses. And so the big advantage of the distributed memory architecture is it is actually somewhat harder work to program. But if you do program in that architecture, you can then deploy your software on a wide variety of computers, including these networks, because in some sense it's the lowest common denominator of computer. All right, so that was the end of our discussion of computer architectures. And the next set of foils are an overview of parallel algorithms and applications. So if there anybody wishes to ask any more questions about architectures, they should ask it now. Otherwise, we'll spend the last 20 minutes discussing parallel algorithms. Okay, so we're going to go on to parallel algorithms. So parallel algorithms is a field of computer science, if you like. It's also the practical methodology for taking a problem and implementing it on a parallel machine. And at this initial discussion, we're just going to briefly describe some of the issues and different characteristics of different forms of parallelism. And we'll actually define three types of parallelism: data parallelism, functional parallelism, and we'll also describe something which I forgot to write down here, pleasing parallelism. And then we will also describe some of the strategies for getting good parallel algorithms, which is essentially minimizing communication, minimizing synchronization, and changing the algorithm to make this work better. On distributed memory machines, synchronization is the technical word you use for saying that you have two tasks which need to be coordinated, and one may need to wait for the other. You actually implement synchronization, say, on distributed memory machines by sending messages. So minimizing synchronization actually ends up the same thing operationally as minimizing message passing. So in many ways, for scientific programming, the most important form of parallelism is data parallelism. So if you look at almost all scientific problems and you ask why it takes a long time to execute, the reason is in some sense straightforward. Let's take an example of weather prediction. So why would it take a long time to predict the weather? It's because if we wish to predict the weather in the United States, we would need to cover the United States in grid points, and then we apply the basic principles of fluid dynamics to the little volumes of air that we've carved out. And if you like, weather predictions, taking the physics, which describes the evolution of these little volumes of air, and applying the same laws of physics at every point in the atmosphere in the United States. So the reason why it takes a long time is there are going to be billions of points in this atmosphere. So data parallel algorithms exploit the fact that if you take scientific problems, they are essentially nearly always implemented by taking an array of data. It could be a very sophisticated array, it needn't be a simple rectangular array, and applying essentially the same algorithm to each point in that array. So somebody asked me a little earlier how big a parallel machine could be. So it's quite important to note that today's problems are often running into the billions of points. I mean, it's easier to see why you might get a billion, because if I did a three-dimensional problem, I might have let's take a simple example. We might have a grid which is 1,000 in the x direction, 1,000 in the y direction, and 1,000 in the z direction. And so that gives you, of course, 10 to the 9th or a billion points. So, and essentially, you can have a level of parallelism which is of order that billion. You can essentially update all those points simultaneously. One way to realize that's true is if you look out into nature today, nature is updating the weather at the given time t. The weather in Mississippi is being updated by nature at the same time as the weather in Syracuse. So nature undoubtedly uses parallelism. So why does that work? Well, it turns out if you look at the physics, it's because weather is controlled by a so-called local algorithm, which means that if I look at these little volumes, any one volume is only impacted by neighboring volumes, because if I'm going a small distance in time, the weather in Syracuse can only care about the properties of the air volumes near Syracuse, and so that's the central locality feature of these physics algorithms, which actually corresponds mathematically to them being described by differential equations. So this is meant to be illustrated by the bottom of this diagram here, which says data parallelism and algorithms. And we notice that here I've taken a chessboard which has red and black squares. It's actually meant to be a two-dimensional atmosphere, say, and the red and black squares are just little squares of air which we wish to update. And if we take the world's simplest algorithm for updating them, you will find that each black square that we updated requires knowledge of the neighboring four red squares. That's what this funny diagram on the left is trying to say, that the AIJ stored in a black square only requires the red squares, knowing the values of the red squares to be able to update it. So if you look at that diagram, you see if I take all the black squares, they're surrounded by red squares, so I can update all the black squares independently. And then having done that, I can update all the red squares independently. And the end of that, I've updated all the points in my grid. And the level of parallelism is the number of points in the grid divided by 2. So that's why I pointed out that essentially in these physics algorithms, the potential parallelism is essentially the number of points in the problem, which is enormous. And so, parallel computing, this is one of the original, I remember I used to make these arguments, again, 15 years ago. Parallel computing is attractive because the algorithms we want to, the problems we wish to solve have built into them enormous parallelism, which is of a size which is much larger than the number of computers we wish to bring to bear on the problem. All right, so now we have some very simple examples which come from, these are very old, I produced these many, many years ago, and they're not terribly good pictures, but we'll show four examples, actually five examples, seismic wave simulation, simulating the universe, computer chess, remember, Deep Blue beat Kasparov, and so we'll see how Deep Blue uses data parallelism to get additional performance. Then we'll show how you could do image processing in parallel, and then we'll do structural mechanics in parallel. All right. So the first picture here has the two examples, the one which is called seismic exploration. Ignore the title, which again comes from the past. And in order to do, if you wish to know when you have an earthquake in Los Angeles, which was of great interest to me when I was at Caltech, which is just outside Los Angeles, the way you do that is you take the Los Angeles basin, you divide the two-dimensional ground area up into little grid points, and then you propagate waves through those grid points, starting where the places the earthquakes happened, and then you calculate the movement of the buildings on top of the ground, and then you see if they fall down by looking at their structural features. So how do we do this in parallel? Well, we take Los Angeles, we divide, here I've taken a very simple case of four computers. We've assumed somewhat incorrectly that Los Angeles is square, so that little thing on the right is just a square array, and we've assigned each processor to a quarter of that array. So the San Fernando Valley has one processor, Hollywood has another processor, Laguna Beach a third processor, and Disney World, or whatever it is, a fourth processor, and so on. So we get the parallelism by simulating the movement of the waves in parallel through these regular grid points. And of course, as I keep telling you, nature propagates earthquake waves in parallel, because again, earthquake waves are governed by one of these local differential equations. This other example, which isn't so clear, which is called universe simulation, is again another classic physics problem. Here we're trying to evolve galaxies in time and to see whether some if you're a famous theorist with a theory about the distribution of galaxies at the beginning of time and you evolve them according to Newton's laws, will they look as they do today? Or maybe you want to evolve them back in time and see if they collapse into a cosmic black hole or whatever we thought started at the beginning of the universe. So the only difference between the universe simulation and the seismic simulation is, again, we have a collection of entities, in this case galaxies. We're going to assign, we have data parallelism because we have Newton's laws, which are the laws of motion. Previously, for the seismic case, we have the laws of wave motion, which we were applying to the displacements in the Earth. Now we have displacements of galaxies, which are controlled by Newton's laws. The major difference technically is that galaxies are very irregularly distributed. There's almost a factor of 1,000 to 1 in the ratio of the maximum density to the mean density in a typical simulation like this. And so whereas you would have a regular grid in the case of the seismic case, in the case of galaxies you'll have a rather irregular grid. And so you actually would, in practice, have to take care of the irregular distribution of points. But again, it's data parallelism. Bunch of points, galaxies, each has the same algorithm, Newton's laws, and galaxies in nature do evolve simultaneously. You can apply Newton's laws simultaneously to all galaxies and evolve them in time and get a level of parallelisms which is equal to the number of galaxies. Next example of data parallelism is a little more contorted. So the way you play computer chess is you take your current position. So here we are, we're trying to beat Kasparov, and we have a certain position. This particular diagram is drawn assuming it's the opening position, because we've had our moves, which are typical opening moves in chess, are pawn to king 4 or pawn to queen 4. And what you do if you're a computer is you take all possible moves for you, then you, for each of those moves, you look at all possible moves for the opponent, and for each of the moves of the opponent, you look for all possible moves for you, and so on. And you generate a tree, a game tree, and then you look at this game tree, which you might go some 10 to 16 levels deep, and you find which move for you gives you the best possible answer when you evolve it down these many levels. And so how do you use parallelism? How does Deep Blue use parallelism on this problem? It actually uses parallelism in a couple of ways, but the way we want to illustrate here, the data parallelism is, it takes this tree and it examines the tree in parallel. Namely, the data here is now the tree, which is the data, is the set of moves, and you look at each of those moves independently. And on the different computers, and you just combine the answer at the end to find out what the actual overall best choice is. So that shows that in data parallelism, you can have grid points, galaxies, moves in a game tree. And here we have this last two examples. Let's do the one at the bottom. Bottom left. So here we have a well-known independent nation called California, which is governed in the west of the United States, and we're assuming that California has decided to declare war on the rest of the United States and has got 4 missile sites and has launched this missile. So how do we use parallelism to try to track these missiles and therefore launch our interceptors in the most effective fashion? Well, again, it's data parallelism. The data in this case is the missiles, and we assign, if we have 4 processors responsible for defending the rest of the nation, you divide California into 4 and assign one of the processors to all the missiles in the quarter of California. And thereby, as these missiles are again obeying Newton's laws, which are independent for each missile, you can track missiles independently and gain a factor of 4 in performance. So this is a so-called pleasingly parallel algorithm because the missiles are independent. They do not interact with each other. And so you gain an immediate factor of 4. The final example is that of a plate. So this is a structural analysis problem, and there happens to be a two-dimensional plate with so-called elements, which we'll discuss later on them. And there happen to be a lot of elements in one point because there's a crack developing here. And the purpose of this picture is to show that to do parallel computing, you again take the elements describing the structure and dividing in this, well, again, I've assumed four processors. You divide them in four, and because all the elements are near the crack, you'll find that the first processor actually, has essentially all the points in the left half of the diagram. The second, the zeroth processor, has all the points in the right-hand side of the processor. And the second processor has those yellow points, and the third processor has those blue points. And although the area covered by the blue points is much smaller than the area covered by the points marked 1, because there are many more points per unit area, the actual computational complexity is actually roughly the same for each processor. So this is actually like the universe simulation problem. In order to get effective parallel computing for this problem, we have to use data parallelism, and then we have to use what's called mapping correctly. We must map the elements of data properly to the processors so as to get roughly the same amount of work and to roughly minimize the communication. And this has actually been done reasonably effectively here. So I'll skip the next two foils, I think. Next three foils. All right, so you should now be getting diligently this foil which says functional parallelism in algorithms. And we'll just start discussing this today, and then we'll stop after this foil. So this is a different type of parallelism, and it's where the parallelism does not come from the data, it comes from the function of the algorithm. And so the example given here is when you're designing an aircraft, and you wish to get some optimal design, you need to trade off the airflow simulation, the structural simulation, and the thermal simulation. So that, for instance, let me give an example. If you wanted to get the best lift to drag ratio, you might require reducing the structure of the wing, but then when you compute the structure, the wing might fall apart. So there's going to be a trade-off to make certain that the aircraft is quiet enough, has correct thermal properties, is strong enough, and has good drag capabilities. So the structural calculation and the fluid flow calculation are an example of functional parallelism. They're different tasks. They actually operate essentially on the same data, but they're different functions or different algorithms applied to the same data set. And so another very good example of functional parallelism, if you have your web browser and you click Netscape, you will find that you see functional parallelism, because when I downloaded this page, the image, which is actually the most complex part of the download, it's assigned a separate thread, whereas the HTML processing is yet in a different thread. And so Netscape makes very extensive use, as of course does Internet Explorer, of functional parallelism in its implementation. And so functional parallelism is extremely important in many practical applications. So we will continue to describe a little more about functional parallelism and also about pleasing parallelism, and then we'll go on to discuss technologies and also some more details about algorithms in the next lectures. So we want to go through this initial material, which is the general motivation. Then we have to start doing MPI as quickly as possible, because that will allow us to set you some nice hard homeworks, which is what you obviously want. So, any questions? Jackson State. Questions are usually done through the chat. Okay, so I'm assuming that there are no questions. I'll be happy to answer any. Just type them in or switch the microphone in and ask them using the audio. So thank you. We'll see you on Tuesday. Can we get the slide? Mike is gone. He's not meant to go. How can we use this system out of class? Those are all good questions. So Nancy must have given you the URL. So the system is called Tango or Tango Plus Web Wisdom. However, it operates by taking a web page and sharing the web page. So the web page is a totally normal web page. So if you go to the URL, which Nancy is diligently going to type, we will wake her up. Yes, here it is. You see, she's typed it in. If you go to that web page, you will find every single foil I discussed today, all the foils Nancy discussed last time, and the foils we discuss next time. They're all sitting on that page. You do not have to have anything on your machine except Netscape, because Tango is only used, which is this slightly complicated, Tango is only used to allow me to transmit audio and video between us, and for us to run these chat rooms, and for us to do these shared browsers. If you want to close Web Wisdom, you can close it. You can just exit Tango. If you leave it, presumably Mike will clean up anyway. If you're logging into a computer, you use whatever username and password you have for that computer. Tango, you can log into Tango with any name under the sun, because Tango screwed up when it comes to security. And Merrick, who used to be listening, is working on that problem and hasn't solved it yet. But it's easy to solve. It's just software. And we have lots of people who write software. But it's not important at the moment, because we're academics and we're teaching you knowledge, and this knowledge is free, so we don't have to make it secure. Any other questions? Thank you very much for being such a patient audience and asking such nifty questions. Thank you. So I'm going to